Hey everyone, welcome back to the Vet Blast podcast. We want to thank our friends at NovaQuist for sponsoring this wonderful conversation as we talk about wound care and innovation in wound care. And I can't think of anyone better to be joining us as we're here live at Fetch Nashville. Before we introduce our friends, let's give it up for Nashville, everybody in the audience. It's good. Thank you very much. Well, we have the one and only Dr. Carl Maritato in the house, and we also have, yes, give a round of applause to Dr. Carl Maritato. And Dr. Kelly Sobey's in the house. Give her a round of applause. So a little bit of information about our colleagues here. Dr. Sobey is a graduate of Michigan State College of Veterinary Medicine. All right, there you go. After graduation, she completed an internship in equine lameness and diagnostics at MSU, College of Vet Med, for equine performance. After completion of the year-long internship, she worked in ambulatory equine medicine and then made a transition into companion animal. In this area of veterinary medicine, she has worked in several capacities, such as the medical director of a veterinary technology program, veterinary associate, and now owner of a companion animal practice. Dr. Kelly has a passion for integrative medicine, encompassing both Western and Eastern medicine modalities for optimal patient care. In general practice, she works to incorporate the latest Western medicine with traditional veterinary Chinese medicine. Dr. Kelly currently resides in Michigan with her wife and three cats. Together, they love to read, travel, and cheer with their two adult children or on in life, which is great. And your wife is here in the audience too. We gotta give her a round. Well, there she is. Dr. Maritato is a board-certified veterinary surgeon at MedVet Cincinnati, where he has been part of the medical team since 2010. Dr. Maritato attended the University of Florida. Go Gators, right? You got it. earned his two Bachelor's of Science degrees at Ross University School of Veterinary Medicine. He earned his DVM degree. Ross University in the house? There we go. After completing residency in 2010, he helped create the MedVet Cincinnati Surgery Department and introduced new surgical options to the Cincinnati community. And last year, he was awarded the 2025 Veterinary Hero Award, DVM 360 in Surgery. Congratulations on that. Excellent. Thank you. He's a co-editor of a textbook and many, many things that he does, the Journal of Small Animal Practice for Veterinary Medicine, Clinician's Brief. His particular interests include neurosurgery, oncologic surgery, and orthopedic surgery. He's had a focus interest on disease of the stifle, angular limb deformities, and minimally invasive fracture repair. All that great stuff. Okay, so we're gonna chat about wounds. Raise your paw if you see wounds daily. Yeah. How about maybe twice a week? And do they come in just like on a, you know, are they scheduled as an appointment or are they usually a come down now kind of a thing? Right, usually like emergency come down now thing. So we're gonna talk about these things. And Dr. Maritato, curious to get your thoughts on this first, the when to close versus when to wait question. So in your experience, where do most veterinarians get it wrong where in deciding between primary closure, delayed primary closure, and second intention? Mm-hmm. And what clinical signals are they missing that should change that direction?
Sure. I think the first thing is the general golden rule. Everything in medicine is a general. But I think if a wound has occurred within the last 3 to 6 hours, and if the wound is clean, and if it is sharp. So you don't want to close a wound that's all raggedy, more than 6 hours old, or you really want to pay attention to the thickness of the skin, because if the whole subdermal plexus has been ripped off and the sub-Q is gone and you're just stitching skin back together, that's going to fall apart, you know? So you want a clean wound within a short period of time, 3 to 6 hours. But if they come in and it's one of these, you know, they've been hit by a car, they've been dragged across the floor, and they've got rocks and dirt, and we don't know when this happened, that's a wound you're going to want to treat at least for probably a couple of days of, and then you can do a delayed closure. But at the same time, depending on the location on the body, anytime you have a chance to just close a wound, you should try to do it. And so if you can just cut it out the same way that you would cut out a tumor and get primary closure, then do that. It's what I would do. Mm-hmm. Because it's going to be faster, easier, and cheaper for the client and less painful for the dog to go through the process.
What about contaminated wounds?
Yeah. So for contaminated wounds, a lot of people don't know this, but tap water is plenty good. It's actually better in some instances than even saline. And there's really no evidence that you need to be pouring topicals of like Chlorhex and all those things. Definitely don't be spraying antibiotics on them. I hear about gentamicin flush and stuff that none of that stuff has any evidence it does anything, but it certainly can create problems. Keep the Chlorhex away from their corneas. Done that. So when the most important thing is just a lot of lavage when they first come in. So you can literally put them over your wet sink and just hose them down and just clip very much all around and just wash it and wash it and wash it. And then depending on how long you feel you need to do that through the different stages that you're going to go in the early phases, again, you could just keep washing it with tap water every day if you need to get it in between your bandage changes. And depending on, and we may talk about this more, but depending on the amount of effusiveness, and especially in that early debridement phase and stuff, those wounds can be highly effusive and disgusting. And then different materials are going to help you with that.
Yeah. Dr. Sobey, when you have these wounds that come in, and just like what Dr. Martard was talking about, what's your go-to? Are you using saline or water to flush out the wounds? And what does that look like at your clinic?
Yeah, in the general practice with us, it's usually we start with water flush, depending on, you know, anything else that's going on with the body. We'll use a little dilute Chlorhex, but mostly it's flushing with tap water.
Okay. Let's ask the audience. Raise your paw if... And there's no right or wrong. We just want to say no blood on the walls, but we're going to say this is real talk. So we just want to know if you're a chlorhexidine. Before we were just talking about, do you use chlorhexidine when you're flushing out a wound? Raise your paw if you're doing that. Okay. What about just regular water, like Dr. Martado was talking about? Okay. Betadine. Anything else that I'm missing? Saline. Okay. Saline.
Can I note? I'm glad I didn't see a lot of hands with betadine, because remember, organic debris completely deactivates betadine. So okay. You're just not doing anything.
Yeah. Okay, so now we know. Yeah, thank you. Let's talk about the chronic non-healing wound problem. So when a wound stalls and refuses to progress, what's the most commonly overlooked driver? Biofilm, perfusion, mechanical stress, or something else? And how do you systematically approach fixing that?
I think, like a lot of things, it's many times a combination of all of those things. I do find, as a referral surgeon, when I get a lot of questions from out in my community, one of the things I find that is frequently a problem is no one's cultured a wound that's stalled. Mm-hmm. And many times it is a biofilm, an infection that's causing this to happen. So remember, culture. Cultures are your friend. And I think that is of paramount, number one. I think that... At location then plays another big role. Some of these wounds that are in very tricky areas like flanks and armpits, those kinds of things, they're gonna be more difficult to deal with. And so recognizing, I think, those wounds from the get-go, and those I think are the kinds of wounds that you really wanna try to not have heal by full second intention the whole way. I think those are wounds that ideally you are trying to get them to a point where they're healthy, but then you can try to do some form of closure, or at least the deeper aspects. You know, these deep pocketing wounds, which the scaphogen potentially can help with, but it's those are the ones that once you've got it at least healthy enough, you want to start trying to tack it from in to out to try to just kill a lot of that dead space. We all know that tension and motion are the enemies of wound healing. Yeah. And then comorbidities of the patient and vascular supply. Again, you really got to pay attention to what is going on with the health of the skin and the vascular supply to the area.
I'm curious to get your approach on this from both a Eastern traditional kind of aspect. Is there anything that you do a little bit differently when you're managing wounds like this?
Yeah, the chronic wounds, we'll use a lot more of the Chinese ointments I don't know if you're too familiar with them, but a lot of them coat very well.
Yeah,
I know. we do a lot of different foods as well. So things that are going to help boost immune function, particularly in those older patients with comorbidities. We'll do a lot of immune boosting, you know, supplements or foods to help with that as well while we're managing the wounds in our normal Western traditional ways.
Okay. You talked about something that's a real issue for me personally in practice. I wish I could culture insensitivity every wound. How many of you struggle because of the price of seeing? So the question is now what, right? So here we're trying to use antimicrobial stewardship. All right, I understand it's important, but there is a challenge when in, you know, real talk, like some clients cannot afford to do culture insensitivity. So what are your recommendations when something like that is a barrier?
Yeah, it's a tough question because I'm a spoiled brat. I'm in referral practice, but I guess the one thing I would say to play devil's advocate would be to try to explain to the client, this is going to take longer and be more expensive if I don't do this one thing right now than if you just let me do this one thing right now. Because, you know, an extra couple of weeks of bandage changes, unless you're doing them for free, you know, they're paying for that every single time they come. And as we start to use, you know, more advanced materials and things, you know, that's just adding to the cost of your bandage. And so if you can cut off time, then that is going to, in the end, I think, you know, back in the day, it was wet to dry bandages, right?
Right.
Way back in the day. Yeah. And then, of course, when the new materials came out, everyone was freaking out that it was expensive. And you're like, we're never going to get the clients to do this. We got to do the wet to dries. But then it took the studies that clearly showed the whole picture. The time period that these wounds were closing with moist wound therapy was half the time. So it was ended up being either the same in cost, but in less time, or even cheaper. So I think that's the trick. If you can't win and you can't do anything, then I think potentially even trying to do some stains and at least try to figure out what bugs are hanging out. If you have rods, you have cocci, so you can try to at least make a bit of a logical decision about what could be there and what you're going to work with. Using the color and the smell, we all know pseudomonas, right? So
yeah.
Trying to guess those things.
Yeah. I know we tried to do such a due diligence of matching the bug to the drug, you know, when doing the best you can. But let's talk about the biology versus, you know, technique question. So up here on the screen, I know my friends here can't see, but these are just some wounds that we're seeing here, general wounds. And how much of wound success is truly about surgical technique versus patient biology? Things like perfusion, nutrition you were talking about. What about comorbidities such as endocrinopathies? Like, what does that look like, Dr. Maritato? And then I'm curious to get your point too, Doctor.
I think there's an old saying, we can't really make a wound heal faster. We can only slow it down. So I do think the body plays a huge role in that, and the comorbidities are huge. I think we are the ones that if we're going to hinder the wound if we don't do things appropriately and just kind of guide it to where it needs to go. So yes, I think the body and the patient, comorbidities, diabetes, thyroid, Cushingoid dogs, those kinds of things, that plays a huge a role in their ability to heal. And then our ability comes in our ability to recognize the stage or the phase of the wound healing and supporting that phase with proper care, proper materials, et cetera. So yeah, I think those are, I think they're equal, but I think the body plays in maybe a bigger role, and because we can only kind of screw up the body if we don't pay attention to it.
Yeah. What about your, any thoughts, Dr. Sobey?
I think with the older patients, particularly with comorbidities, and I don't know if others experience the same thing, but their pet is not feeling well, they're not eating the greatest with these chronic painful wounds. So they're not giving their medications like they should if they've ever stopped their diabetes medication or their thyroid medication, and just trying to educate them that while we're managing these wounds to also continue to manage those comorbidities so that we can encourage the body to heal in the fashion that we know it's supposed to and in the time frame that it's supposed to. So I think that's one of the biggest things I try to encourage is we also need to continue to manage all the other things that are going on with that pet. And
all right.
I think there's no there's no better healing machine than the body. And it's our job to just assist it, you know, like back in the day when we fixed a fracture, it was put every single piece back together you possibly could at the expense of stripping all the blood supply and everything else. Yeah. And of course, now we don't do that. We recognize we want the body to do its job. So our job is to support the body and the body will do it.
It's a great point, because have you ever seen them come in and you're like, how in the world are we going to close this wound? And then you check and you're like, holy Kelly Clarkson. They're like, it's resolving beautifully, you know, obviously with assistance, but the body, to your point, is really remarkable. What about degloving injuries? And if you see those, raise your hand if you see a lot of degloving injury and you're like, oh my gosh, like, where do I begin with this?
I was just going to say, to your point, degloving injuries are they're the poster child for when you have new employees to see something like that and they think the animal has to be put down, and then you're like, chill out.
Yeah.
Give it 3 months and you'll see what this will look like, right? Including the ligament that's completely ripped off and their ankle is flopping the other direction. You don't even have to fix that. It'll all just heal and stabilize, and it's fascinating.
Yeah, it's remarkable. So on your tables, everybody, you should hold them up and show everyone. Let's just make sure you have one. You should have the 4 stages of wound healing there. Thank you to NovaQuist for this. This is something that you can put into your practice. We'll talk a little bit more about that, but let's talk about the 4 stages of wound healing, because I think it's a good refresher for us to understand what that entails. So Dr. Maritato, do you mind just covering them high level, what that looks like?
Sure, yeah. So wound happens, and luckily we bleed. Hopefully it stops, but we bleed. Most important part of that, of course, is platelets are going to come in. They're going to stop the bleeding, but they're also going to release tons of helpful factors, right? All these factors are going to draw in the white cells. The first cells to come in first, like 3 to 5 days, are going to be all your neutrophils, and they're going to try to debride and kill and clean. And then they're also going to release factors that are going to draw in the monocytes, which are going to morph into macrophages, and they are going to lay the groundwork for the next phase, right? And so the next phase after the debridement period is going to be the granulation, which is, of course, proliferative phase. And essentially, at that point, the extracellular matrix is very important, because the monocytes are going to use this extracellular matrix to call in fibroblasts to try to start building. And they're also going to pull in new vascular supply. And that's why in the early phases, the granulation is super, super pink, hopefully. And then as a wound matures, it gets a little bit paler and paler and paler. And then, of course, during that same time period, you're going to get some of these fibroblasts are going to convert into myofibroblasts that are going to start contracting the wound. So they'll contract. And at the same time that that's happening, the signals have also told the epithelium on the edge that you need to start proliferating and try to epithelialize from the outset. So you've got all of these things, of course, are not happening on a cut timeline. They're all overlapping. But that's essentially what's happening. And that's how you can try to visualize the wound is, you've got this effusive, ugly looking thing in the beginning. That's your debridement phase. And then you've got starting to see sprouts of red, pinkish tissue. That's where you're starting to get your proliferative phase. And then eventually it'll just become a lawn of granulation. And then that's going to shrink over time as it matures.
Excellent. Yeah, it sounds perfect, but we know in reality it needs a little bit of assistance, of course. So Kelly, most wounds we see in practice aren't flat. They have depth and irregular margins. Why is it that traditional management, which often relies on 2D dressing, fails to address the physical volume of a deep wound that Carl was talking about? And what are some potential clinical consequences of leaving that dead space?
When I've done bandaging with the really deep wounds, again, if you're sending them home, I find that the owners don't understand the concept of bandaging or how we're trying to keep contact with all surfaces. So that becomes one of the biggest drawbacks for me, is that we can't keep that dead space in contact with appropriate surfaces or bandaging techniques or things that we've been applying, like the sheets or the honey or the scaffogen, in that looking for different modalities in treating those cases is often where I need to go, is that traditional bandaging isn't always going to work with those patients because of the owner compliance. And I know we've all seen those at home where they think the bandage was just, you know, they put a piece of vet wrap over it after we've sent them home with all these supplies and things.
And Carl, we're just talking about dead space. What are some indications for drains? Talk to us a little bit about putting those wonderful Penrose drains in, right, guys?
I'm not a friend of drains. Yeah, I do avoid drains at all costs, particularly Penrose drains. But again, we live in a bit different world sometimes, so I respect what you have to do. I will say, if you are using drains, please always just remember that gravity, you don't need the drain sticking out the top of the dog because it only drips down. So it's just another port of entry for bacteria to come through the top. So try not to do that. I think the first thing is try to close as much dead space as you can. Just tack and tack and tack and tack as much as you can. But yeah, there are some of these cases that just have just massive amounts of pocketing. And I don't know the difference in cost, but if you look into Jackson Pratt drains and at least maybe just have a couple in the hospital for if you get one of these really massive ones that a Penrose is really not going to cut it, a Jackson Pratt would make a lot of difference because then you can potentially close wound over a large space, put it in a Jackson Pratt, and that constant suction will keep it down. But I think the other thing with the pocketing wounds and deep wounds, the things to remember is that if you're managing them as an open wound, I always say granulation can't heal to granulation. So the problem with those wounds is you get this granulation along the crater's edge, but then those two ends can't kind of stick to each other very well. You know, granulation has to try to come up as one field all at once. And I think that's where something like the scaffogen and these products can potentially help with that because it can allow the granulation to try to drive across that scaffold and help with that as well.
Yeah. I think the reason for some of those, as me as a GP, I always worry about dehiscence, you know, wound dehiscence. Anybody have issues with dehiscence out there? I see a lot of head nods. It's a real thing that happens in practice. So what are some reasons why dehiscence happens?
I think one is incorrect closure, right? So closing too early, closing a wound that's not healthy. Again, skin is too thin. You didn't notice that the subdermal plexus has been ripped off, shearing injuries, those kinds of things. And then tension, inappropriate suture size, maybe something that's too small for what you're trying to deal with. Or if you are suturing later in a wound, so you're doing more of a delayed closure and you're suturing some granulation, remember when you're doing that, granulation doesn't hold suture at all. So what I teach my interns and residents is when you're suturing through that kind of tissue, every time you take a bite, before you do anything else, just pull up every single time. It slows things down, but it's better than it coming back in 3 days. So just pull up and make sure you're not ripping your suture right through. If you are, it's not a deep enough bite. That's a problem. And so I think that's kind of a collection of things that can lead to dehiscence. Unhealthy wound, too much tension, and not taking proper bites, things like that.
Right. Kelly, many practitioners find advanced sheets to be expensive and wasteful because they require trimming to fit the wounds and may still struggle to conform to a regular bed. So how do we move beyond sheets to a 3D matrix that fills the entire defect without the waste or the calming bridging effect?
I think products like scaffogen have certainly helped with those type of, and we've all seen them on the distal limb, and you're trying to cut these sheets to fit these irregular wounds and you're wasting half the sheets. And then the clients are wondering why the cost is so high with these, is looking at different modalities that can cover that wound and put that scaffold in, also keep it moist. Because that's part of our healing as well. If we let these wounds dry out too much, you know, granulation tissue doesn't like that. So looking at doing things that are going to help build that bridge, get that moisture and keep that healing process while not, you know, making it unaffordable for the clients to treat some of these wounds. Because we've all seen them in general practice. The owners are panicked that they're going to have to come back for all these bandage changes, that they're going to have to do all these expensive things, and they don't feel that they can do that. And none of us want that to end there with that patient because of a cost concern.
What are your thoughts, Dr. Martato?
No, I don't know that I can make that better. I think it was great. Yeah, I think, yeah, it's, there's definitely an advantage to liquids in a product like this because you don't have to, you know, I love calcium alginates, been using them for, gosh, my whole career, it seems. But yeah, some of these wounds, you know, they're just the shape and everything else. I mean, we do, a lot of times what we'll do with something, if you are using something like an alginate or the copa foams, those kinds of things, is if we don't need to use all of it in the wound, we'll just trim out what we want. And then we keep the package, we write the patient's name on it because they're coming, you know, back and forth to see us every few days or whatever, you know. But moving towards these new technologies, you know, can certainly alleviate that, those kinds of issues, particularly for the length of the wound.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk about hydrogels. So hydrogels brought us the benefit of moisture, but in deep pockets, they often lack the residency or the body to stay in place. Is there a line where a wound needs more than just hydration, where it needs a structured physical framework?
Yeah, I think in my opinion, it would be wounds that are a bit deeper. You know, I think wounds that are pretty superficial, not necessarily an abrasion, still an actual wound, but you know, some of these wounds that are on the forelimbs and things or the hind limbs, there's only so deep they're going to get. But up on the trunk and so forth, they can really get deep. And those are the real struggles. But I do think something like this could work, you know, will work very well on any wound. Mm-hmm. And just potentially help speed it up. And to your point, moisture is the key. You know, moist wound healing is critical. And so this definitely helps with that.
Okay. Before we go into Scaffagen, because I'm going to introduce this new product to you guys, I don't think you probably heard of it. Has anyone heard of Scaffagen yet? Raise your hand if you've, anyone? The owner. Okay, got it. But I know many of you are sitting in your chairs talking about the elephant in the room. We gave this talk in Charlotte, and we probably can go on forever talking about this, but this is medical grade honey, Manuka honey. So raise your hand if you are using that for wound management. Wow, I'd say almost all of you are. So let's talk about it. So medical grade honey has been a staple, but its fluid nature means it often migrates or it runs in high motion areas in the distal limb, for instance. How do we move beyond honey, or what are the benefits of it? Or, you know, what does that look like to a modality that offers engineered positioned stability?
And I like the Manuka honey. If you guys are all like me, do you have problems actually getting owners to use medical grade Manuka honey? Or are they going to the local grocery store and just grabbing something and continuing to think that they're doing great? How many have had the bandage being eaten because they're rewarding them with something nice and happy and sweet for licking at their wound? Mm-hmm. So I've honestly moved away from medical grade honey because of that. I think it does wonderful. It has the antimicrobial, it has the, you know, this, but in owner compliance, I've moved away from it because the Kroger brand honey is not going to do the job that we would like it to do.
Yeah. In my world, I use honey once we get to a certain point, after I get past a massively effusive phases of the wound, to help keep it healthy, keep infection away. But I have not, luckily I've not encountered the tasty treats, but again, because of what I do, I don't have the owners having to deal with the wound management themselves. We're doing it for them every X days, depending on the wound. So I guess I would, the one thing I would say is when you have that luxury, you know, I know it, every client's different, so treat every client different. When you have the luxury of saying, if you can let me do your bandage changes, that would be great. And then kind of go from there. But yeah, I've been using honey for a long time. But I'm certainly excited about this product to see how it can help me in the future.
Yeah, so we have this new product. I feel like I'm in QVC. This is Scaffagen. But we're going to talk about this too. I just want to show on camera so that way those of you watching this on demand what this looks like. But this is what you would get as a general practitioner purchasing this box in clinic. And we'll go through what this looks like. But one's for in-clinic use and the others is for the pet owner to use at home for their pet. So let's talk about this, Dr. Maritato, a little bit more about the Scaffagen that, you know, it's a 3D matrix, so it conforms to 3D matrix. How does this change your approach to avoid compared to using topical ointments or flat dressing?
Yeah, I think it's certainly, the biggest thing is craters, wounds that are deep, being able to just put that in there. And then depending, you know, I know we were talking earlier about how you've had plenty of wounds where you just put that on and that's mm-hmm. it.
There's, let it go.
Yeah, just let it go. Which I think is great for certain wounds. You know, I'm excited about that. But also, if you're not in a situation where you can do that and you're still applying a bandage, in my head, I would see putting this all in the wound to let it do its job, and then, you know, probably putting over some kind of a Kendall foam, Copa foam, and then wrapping it so the animal doesn't go at it. But, you know, it's kind of like when they first started doing Stelfonta, and my oncologists were like, look at that, we're not supposed to touch it. And I was like, oh, okay. But then sure enough, they healed well. So change is tough sometimes.
Yeah, but absolutely.
Yeah.
That's a behavior that needs to be changed. So Kelly, what is it? What is Scaffagen? Here, I'm gonna give you the box so that way you can show them what's in it and how it works and all that.
So Scaffagen, it's a 3D extracellular matrix wound gel. It is a hydrogel as well. It's very easy to apply if you can get it out of the box. But it comes in a very nice with the applicator tip where you can apply it, owners can apply it, and you can also take it off to apply to larger wounds by having the more open. It's a clear. It's also not toxic. So if you're not using it with bandaging technique, which you certainly can, but if you're not and the animals do lick it, or you have children in a home that get into something, you know, you don't have to worry about it having other effects, unintended effects on that patient. Me using it, I had very good owner compliance with it. They thought it was very easy to apply. They thought it was very, the animal didn't react in the ways that some of our other topicals and things, you know, it's not a spray where they're scared of being spritzed with something. So it was very comfortable for most owners to feel that they could do this at home, and also not be afraid that they were continuing to hurt their patient.
I want to talk more about this too, the pet parent variable, because it's a huge component when we're talking about wound management and follow through and rechecks. We can perform all these complex procedures in the clinic, but then the patient goes home to a pet parent that they may struggle with complex protocols or bandage tolerance, or the instructions are just so complex. In your experience, how does moving to a structured framework on day zero change the efficiency of the clinic by reducing the management complications and constant rechecks that often stem from poor at-home compliance?
Yeah, again, for me, it's been because people don't want to come back for the bandage changes. You have people that are afraid to look at blood or open wounds or things at home. They think they know sometimes what's better. Honey, coconut oil seems to still be a fad, putting that on
peroxide.
Everything.
Peroxide,
yes. Putting that in ears and on wounds and trying to educate them that you've actually slowed down our healing process. And I can't imagine what your pet is feeling. But looking at some of these 3D matrix, these hydrogels, has certainly helped with some compliance, because I don't have people complaining about bandage changes. I don't have people complaining that they have to come back for further care. We can set up a more structured framework. I utilize a lot of people using our email. Send me pictures, keep me posted, let me see these, you know, this progression. you know, apply it twice a day, you know, send those pictures in. And if we need you to come back in, you know, we will do that. And we've had a lot more of our pet parents be much more compliant because they feel we're trying to, you know, work with them and help their pet, but not just take their money, because we all get accused of that, that we're just here to make money when we're not. So that's where I see these helping more with that compliance at home.
Let's take a look at these pictures. I just want to see where we're at on these. I think, yeah, Kelly, walk us through the picture. This is from day 1, 7, 13, and 15 days. Walk us through, and this is with scaffolding, right?
Yes, this okay. This kitty came in to us. Owners had no idea what caused this wound, how long it had been there. He was indoor, outdoor. They did not want to do anything above and beyond. Surgical intervention or any of that was not an option. So convincing them to, you know, let us do the wound management with the scaffogen. We also did treat with antibiotics because we all did not know if this cat had been bit, abscess, or what it was. But when he came back for his scheduled rechecks, I will say the owner was very pleased with how the product applied and stayed in place, and that he didn't try to mess with the wound. And he did great.
And then let's take a look at the next one.
We applied it in clinic, and then we did send them home with the scaffogen, and we had them apply it twice a day. Yep. Nope.
So the question is, what was the question?
If they do warm packs or cold packs or things like that prior to application, no. I will tell you, I usually keep it in the fridge just because I do think that cooling effect helped some patients. Just a nice cooling over, you know, some of these are very inflamed. As they're healing, they can get very itchy. And, you know, my just personal opinion was I thought the cooling helped with that. Also telling people, if this looks really horribly dirty, the cat went back outside because, you know, he won't let you keep him inside. If it's very dirty, just use tap water to make sure it was clean before application.
And this is a dog on day 1 and day 13?
Yeah, so day 1, I will say that had been there for 4 years. I inherited this case. No cultures were ever done. Owners were very frustrated after 4 years at this point, didn't want to do anything else. And we, you know, talked them through, hey, let's try this product. And that was the only thing that was done with him. They do not e-collar him. They do not bandage. We just applied the scaffogen, and we were, both owner and myself, were very, very pleased with how this transitioned. Because one of my bigger fears with this guy is after 4 years of having this, that we now had also behavioral aspects of we're just going to pick at a scab because we can now. And he actually did not lick at the area. And once we got past that, you know, taking the pictures and that, he did not go back to licking or having an open wound.
But wait, what about horses?
Yes, not my case personally, but this was a cut on the forehead. The scaffogen was applied. And it was a very large cut on the forehead. This doesn't quite show you the extent on the full horse's head. But that was all they did as well, was apply scaffogen. And I believe they were also doing it twice a day with this, and no bandaging of it.
And this one?
Another equine. On day 1, that was the second time that wound had dehisced. They weren't sure why, whether it was because it's a high motion area or because there was infection. But after the second dehiscence, they started applying the scaffogen and actually did get resolution of that wound at that point. Mm.
And then that one?
This is actually one of our clinic cats. This is Baby Butters. He's 20 and has pretty significant arthritis.
through his spine. And this is a self-inflicted leg wound because of his arthritis. We do other things to treat the underlying cause, because Scaffagen or any of our wound modalities are not going to heal our wounds if we're not addressing why the underlying cause of the wound in some of these cases. So he does get laser for his arthritis. He does get joint supplements. But when he self-traumatizes like this, we use the Scaffagen. And you know, one of the bigger reasons we chose that is because we can't bandage the area, as well as he won't lick it. He leaves it alone versus other topicals that we had tried. He was instantly trying to lick them off. So it was a very pleasant thing to see that in applying these, we weren't getting the animals instantly trying to remove them for us.
And how long would one application last?
I usually do it twice a day, but when we're doing bandage changes in that, it's actually lasted for a good 24 to 48 hours being stable under the bandage.
Okay. And then at home care for the client to use, how often?
At home, I usually do tell them a twice a day, so a Q12 hour. And it's not necessarily that every wound needs that, but I'm sure all of you have also found that if we tell them twice a day, we'll at least get once a day. Where if we tell them once a day, they may do it every other day. So that was one of the bigger reasons for looking at the twice a day application.
And after application of Scaffagen, does the wound need to be bandaged?
It depends on your protocol and how you are feeling with the wound, but a lot of them I did not bandage with it, and there are different factors for that. You know, the individual patient, as well as you know, the concern for at-home care as well. But no, you don't have to bandage with it, but you can certainly use it with your bandaging techniques. I wouldn't use a wet to dry because you're just going to pull it off. But yes.
All right. I'll repeat your question. So go ahead. Say, we have a question in the audience here. What was her question?
The question was, is it safe to use in a dehist post neoplasia removal? I would say yes, because it's just a hydrogel, so you wouldn't have an issue. Yeah.
Yes. How many of you are using photobiomodulation for wounds? Great. Okay. Could you use Scaffagen with other modalities like photobiomodulation?
Absolutely. I love those type of modalities. You know, we look at class 4 lasers, we look at fovea. And I would say you want to do those modalities before you apply Scaffagen, you know, so you're not causing issues with that.
Yeah.
But no, I love using the different modalities. I will do a lot of acupuncture on some of these patients as well to try to help with inflammation, pain management, and that too. So
I have a lecture later this morning, a 30-minute lecture beyond the bandage. We're going to talk about a little bit more on that and what this looks like from a practice management perspective as well. We're going to take some questions in the audience. I know multiple hands were raised, so I'll start in the front row.
I'm just wondering how big or how much of a treatment you can get from one box.
How much or how big can you get from a treatment from one box?
Okay, so the clinic bottle, as long as you're not treating huge wounds, you're looking at about 40 applications. The send home for the client, again, as long as they're applying it appropriately and not globbing it on them, you're looking at roughly about 20 applications.
Yes. The question is, you have to be concerned about areas such around the eyeballs or sensitive areas like that.
And always, yes. But again, it's a hydrogel, so it's not, you know, going to cause major issues. But I think we all want to keep things out of the eye as much as possible. I'm sure you feel the same way.
Yeah. Been there, done that.
I saw someone in the far back. Yes. Oof. I'm struggling. I have a hearing aid. I really can't hear. But can you yell it? Like, use your chest voice.
Give me a
microphone.
In layers.
Okay. So the question is for our people on podcast, are you applying on larger wounds and layers and so forth?
Yes, I have. In particularly if I'm bandaging, I'll make sure that it gets through the deeper layers and you know that we keep it moist in that. But also too with the take home, if we're not bandaging, I will use it in the deep wounds. I will say I've put it into an anal gland abscess. Once we've cleaned and debrided, I've put it into the abscess and then sent home the client bottle. For them to do a twice a day application with that. And they've all healed very well.
Okay. I got you. A question in the back and then in the center, we see you. Yeah. Oh, you're good? Oh.
Get my steps in.
Here we come. Microphone's coming your way. Coming in hot.
I just wondered, how thick is the solution? How do you apply it? You just put a drop on and use the nozzle? Do you use a Q-tip? And how thick an application do you? So the thickness of the stuff itself, how to apply it, and then how thick a layer do you want to apply? Just barely a thin layer?
You want it to be a very nice kind of uniform, getting all aspects of the wound. Certainly if there's deeper pockets, you're going to fill that a right. little bit more. With the application nozzle, you know, like going right into the anal gland, and that was very easy to apply. But usually I you know, get it kind of covered, and then we'd use, you know, whatever to, you know, bandaging technique you guys like. If it's smaller wound, you know, Q-tip, just making sure it's nice, evenly applied over the wound. I don't think you need large thickness. I mean, you're looking at a couple millimeter, for your more superficial wounds. And certainly, you know, making sure it goes to the edges of the wound.
So do you use the nozzle to do that? Or do you use a Q-tip?
You know, we can use, our gauze squares, those type of things, just making sure.
You don't want to waste too much.
Yeah, we don't want to waste too much. But just making sure that there's a nice layer. I mean, we'll also, you know, put a glove on and make sure that we get it in as well. You know, I always tell owners at home, wear a glove.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep.
Do you know if it can be used in exotic wounds, like rabbits, guinea pigs, mice, any type of, like, birds, things like of that nature?
Yes. So, you know, right now we've got the data for, you know, cats, dogs, and horses. I will tell you, my daughter raises ball pythons, and we have used them on wounds in them. And I did not see any adverse effects with it, other than they just don't like us touching them with stuff. So,
awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, it's not the ideal way that we would like to manage a wound, but yes, if we can't get it, I mean, we'll use it with the other modalities. We'll hit them with everything that we possibly can, laser fovea, here's your injectable antibiotics and pain meds, and we'll cover the wound with that and then send them home. So yes, I do feel that we had some positives. Was it the ideal wound management situation? No.
I'll take one more question before we wrap up. I know that in my session later this morning, our friends at Scaffagen will be having a QR code for those of you sending in to get some free samples. So that'll be fun. Thank you.
You just mentioned to not do like a wet to dry bandage with it. In my practice, we're seeing a lot of like either second opinion wounds or just like really traumatic wounds. Are you waiting then for the wound to be less effusive? Or are you putting a Telfa pad on? Like, what are you putting on over the top if it's needing a bandage?
Yeah, if they're like that, oftentimes I'll wait till after the first, you know, phase of wound healing and then, you know, start applying it.
Yeah.
Just to follow up on that. You definitely don't want to do any form of wet to dry bandage. But I think these things are going to be most beneficial when you are past the phase of massive amounts of effusion. You know, if you've got large volumes of effusion in the very, very early phases of a wound, if it's very effusive, the hypertonic saline gauzes, those are excellent to draw that out. And then after, usually only use those cure salts for like a day or two. And then from there, if it's still effusive, which it probably will be if it was that bad, I jump into alginates for those because they just absorb massive amounts of fluid. And then usually by day 5 to 7, you should be at a point where you don't necessarily have a large amount of granulation yet, but it's probably going to be a less effusive to where this stuff, I think, would be really beneficial. Would you agree with that? Okay.
I know you said that quick about wet to dry, but I think it's important because we talked about this in Charlotte and had a conversation about that, the wet to dry bandage, yay, nay?
Well, you know, in human medicine, you'll be sued because it's not even close to standard of care. It's considered malpractice. So again, we live in a different world and we have to make do with what we can. But I think that you need to take that thought process and apply that to what you're doing. So, yeah. You know, if it's considered that bad, it's because we know it's so incredibly detrimental. And all it does is delay wound healing, because every time you remove it, you're just ripping off all the good stuff. So you need to find yourself a product or two that you're comfortable using, keeping in your hospital, finding a cost-effective management system, which sounds like you're going to help them with in another lecture. But get yourself set up that can be done so that you can treat the wounds appropriately and follow a good standard of care.
I love that. Yeah, I think that's a good, as we're wrapping up, closing of thoughts, what would be, you know, one mind shift, ooh, that was a close one, huh? Mindset shift to veterinarians managing challenging wounds.
I think I would go with moist wound healing. It's probably the most important thing to remember if that's not already your mindset. Wounds, once they are at a certain point, I do find they do like to be left alone. You know, once they reach a certain point, I'm like, take that bandage off and just let it finish its job. But very early in the processes, you want to do everything you can to support the environment, and the way you support that environment is with proper moist wound management, and that's the biggest thing. So I would spend some time educating yourselves on moist wound management, autolytic debridement, and how the body does that, and what products can support that.
No, I agree. I think we've been sometimes too aggressive to do bandages when we don't need them. And again, working with some products, you know, that are newer out on the market like these have helped me move from just going, oh, everything has to have a bandage. I'm certainly moving away from the wet to dry bandages and looking at, you know, that we have, that the body does heal, that it will heal itself. We are just here to help it in positive ways to do that.
Excellent. Our friends at Scaffagen, by the way, are NovaQuest, their booth is 2004. So when you walk into the exhibit hall, if you haven't yet, it's in the far, far back, straight in the back, and you can't miss them too. So they'll be able to help answer any further questions for you guys as well. Dr. Kelly Sovey, Dr. Carl Maritato, give them a round of applause, everyone. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for tuning in. Don't forget to rate the podcast as we continue to grow. And we'll see you next time right here on the Vet Blast Podcast. Take care, everybody.